Russia's relationship with China has strengthened in recent years. This hour, a look at that strategic relationship and how the world order is evolving. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first half hour is global policy scholar Cheryl Cross, who's speaking this evening in Des Moines. She's co-author of the soon-to-be-published book, China, Russia, and 21st Century Global Geopolitics. Then in the second half hour, we'll hear from Jim Cochran and Soren Prell, scientists at Iowa State University, who've been working on a project with the Large Hadron Collider. That's the world's largest particle accelerator in Switzerland. That's coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Cheryl Cross, director of the Kosmetsky Center at St. Edward's University, also global policy scholar at the Kennan Institute, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's co-author with Paul Bolt of a soon-to-be-published book titled China, Russia, and 21st Century Global Geopolitics. She joins us now in our Des Moines studio. Cheryl Cross, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ben. Nice to be here.
Let's mention that you're in Des Moines today for a talk with your co-author, Paul Bolt, for the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. That happens this evening. Let's talk a little bit about your forthcoming book. You focus on the evolution of Russia's relationship with China. Describe how you see, broadly speaking, that relationship evolving in recent years.
Well, particularly since Russia's annexation of Crimea and the repercussions with respect to the Western security and economic community, you saw not really a pivot at that point, but much more of an acceleration in Moscow's interest in forging stronger ties in Asia, and particularly with Beijing and China. Mm-hmm. So that was a dramatic turning point in 2014, and China and Russia's relationship has developed at the bilateral level on multiple fronts, particularly over the last couple of years. And they have what they call a strategic partnership. They aren't allies, but there's a considerable coincidence of interests on a number of issues in international politics. And while they both seek to and understand the importance of the relationship with the United States, they also share the objective of serving as a counterweight in many respects to U.S. influence in the international community.
So uniting as a counterweight to the United States is one of their strategic interests they share.
Yes. And, you see this coincidence of interests with respect to issues like cyber strategy in the international community, where they both share the interest in maintaining much more of a domestic control and influence on managing issues of cybersecurity. They want to see this managed in the context of the United Nations and international legal bodies, but not the private sector. Their positions on Syria, where they have been supportive more or less of the position of Bashar al-Assad. And even though China has maintained a longstanding commitment to non-interference in internal affairs of countries, still, they attributed much of what happened with respect to Ukraine and Crimea to Western instigation and destabilizing the regime. So they took a neutral policy with respect to Ukraine and were, in some respects, quite critical of what they called Western meddling in Ukrainian politics, threatening a sovereign government there. So,
mm-hmm. And they are all about not meddling in internal politics.
That's right.
Both of them have that very strongly in common.
That's right. Both of them place the highest primacy on maintaining state security. And that's another area where they find common ground. You mm-hmm. know, both nations see the importance. I mean, I think this was particularly accelerated after the Arab Spring, where they had concerns about this contagion of potential domestic instability that could threaten regime security and stability. And so there's a lot of discussion about opposition to perceived Western intervention in the so-called colored revolutions. Promoting regime change in the international community is an area where they both find a common position in opposing the United States and the West. Mm-hmm. They see these efforts toward promoting democracy as instigating chaos in the international community.
And where do they see themselves now in 2017 in regards to those uprisings? These were a series of uprisings against autocratic, authoritarian rule here, which, as we know, looking at many of the states, didn't go so well.
That's right. Absolutely. And they blame the West for that, and the United States, and what they see is an irresponsible policy on the part of the West in terms of instigating turmoil and with potentially negative outcome, you know, in the destabilizing not only those societies, but the broader security environment.
Mm-hmm. You said they have a strategic partnership, China and Russia, but they are not allies. I'm wondering, explain the difference.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about allies, it's really something like we've got with respect to nations in NATO, and that is that an attack on any nation would activate Article 5, and we have a commitment to defend our allied partners in that case. The relationship with China and Russia is a strong partnership, but they aren't making a commitment to support each other with respect to all international issues. I think they're both concerned about retaining that degree of flexibility that they wouldn't want to be drawn into the conflict of the other nation, you know, where there are different interests at stake. And there are still some differences. They have historic legacies of the past in terms of tensions with respect to issues regarding the border. They claim that most of that has been solved, but still there's that residual suspicion still remains in the back of their minds. And also, there's been a lot of progress with respect to managing their relationship in Central Asia, but still Russia had a longstanding privileged role in Central Asia. And I think there's a certain concern still about potential competition with China and how that could be managed in the long run. So mm-hmm. there are areas for still potential friction, but certainly, again, particularly after 2014 and the developments over Ukraine, the two powers have moved much closer together. And Russia, with respect to Russia, they've been more willing to compromise than they were on certain issues in the past to help offset the difficulties they're having with their relationship in the West.
My guest this half hour, if you've just joined us, Cheryl Cross of Visiting Iowa, global policy scholar. Talk a little bit about when we put Russia on the one side and China on the other side. Compare them for us in terms, broadly speaking, of economic power.
Well, obviously, you know, China has a tremendous advantage with respect to the economic capacity in the international system. And, of course, this is one concern also with respect to Russia that, you know, the idea that they didn't want to be there's a lot of discussion about the fact that Russia didn't want to be a junior partner. They complained a lot with respect to NATO that they were going to never take a secondary role in the Western security structure. But I think this is also a concern with respect to China that they really don't want to have to take a secondary role, but they're not in a position to compete or match China economically in the international system. And so there's always this issue of how that triangular relationship between the United States, China, and Russia would be managed in a condition where Russia is so significantly disadvantaged in the economic sphere. Of course, Russia remains a nuclear superpower. They're an enormous nation with tremendous natural resources. But in terms of sheer capacity to exert economic influence in the international community, they certainly are at a considerable disadvantage with respect to China. And again, you know, I think that there's a understanding that they certainly don't want to trade a situation where they felt like they were in a secondary role in Europe and the West, and with respect to the United States, to some kind of lesser status relationship with respect to Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the sort of the power dynamics play out in all of this and considerations.
What happens when you put them side to side in comparison in terms of military might?
Military might, it's not, you don't see such an extensive difference in terms of the, you know, there's a obviously closer Russia. I think Syria is very important because it demonstrated their capacity to continue to project considerable military influence outside of Eurasia. And there's obviously been considerable issues with respect to military reform within Russia. But on that level, there's a closer parity than in the economic sphere, certainly.
Would it be fair to say that Russia still in some way plays the part of a global, a superpower of the old Soviet Union, whereas China is more of a regional power?
Well, I think China's been more conservative in asserting their influence in the international community. I mean, Russia, as you say, still carries that legacy of the Soviet Union, where they had longstanding relationships around the world. And I mean, their big concern is regaining that great power status in the international community. On a psychological level, in terms of identity, I don't think the Russian population has ever been willing to accept less than great power status in the international community. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important issue area where, and a lot of times experts talk about Russia punching above its weight, where for so many years China talked about they would present themselves in the world as a developing power, that they don't want to, they're not interested in confrontation. Russia and Vladimir Putin have been quite bold and willing to take on considerable risk in confronting the Western security order.
Mm-hmm. It might be puzzling to some because when we saw the demise of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, that was put to the fact that the Soviet economy could not keep up with the military might it was possessing across the country. Isn't that true now with the Russian economy? They're still projecting this military might, or has the Russian economy changed and become stronger than it was in Soviet times?
Well, you know, I've never really accepted the argument that it was that the end of the Cold War was brought about exclusively by the lack of capacity to manage in the economic sphere, because I think, you know, individuals can matter significantly in international politics, too. And all of the reforms that were brought about by the Gorbachev era were partly structural in reaction to structural circumstances and economic conditions, certainly. But also, I think a different individual at the helm of power in the Soviet Union at that time may have made all the difference in the world. In other words, I think Gorbachev had a vision of new thinking in the international community. He talked about the common European home, about building cooperation with the West. So a lot of it had to do with the orientation that Gorbachev brought to the helm and also those advisors that were around him at the time. So I think it was a driving force. Economic circumstances were a factor, but it didn't necessarily have to develop in that way. It was more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl Cross, you've outlined a little bit on broadly speaking how the Chinese relationship with the Russians has evolved in recent years. Let's have you comment on how that partnership is shaping the world order, in particular the U.S. role in the U.S. and maybe start off by telling us what do we mean by that term world order.
Well, I think it's very much the case that the Chinese and Russians share the position that, let me say this, the Chinese have benefited by the Western liberal order, by the Western rules of the game, even though they had nothing to do with establishing those rules. Their economic rise and their development has certainly been facilitated by engagement with that order. So both countries, however, both Moscow and Beijing share the position that they oppose what they perceived as U.S. hegemony in the international system. They believe that the United States needs to have a counterweight in terms of influencing the international community. So I would say the difference lies in the fact that the Chinese are more cautious They seek perhaps a gradual transition of the Western order in accordance with that would more accurately, more appropriately reflect their preferences and their interests. The Russians have been much more bold in challenging that Western liberal order, the rules of the game, most clearly perhaps illustrated in the intervention and involvement in Ukraine, mm-hmm. annexation of Crimea. Mm-hmm. So, but that's a major area for common interests that, you know, moving forward in the 21st century, that they don't see the world system, their interests being well served by any sort of order that the United States, that they perceive as the United States, is having disproportionately or overwhelming superiority or influence. Mm-hmm. And so, and it also comes down to questions of values. I mean, Vladimir Putin and the Russian foreign policy community speak very much in terms of this contradiction in values. They've talked placed orthodoxy and the values of religious conservatism in Russia as in some way superior to what they see as decadence in the West, in Western Europe, which is also another very interesting dimension of all of this. Mm-hmm. So it's about nations' perceptions of interests, about the international system in a state of transition, and how these two major players will contribute to shaping the dynamics of that system moving forward into the decades of the 21st century. And that's a big part of the focus of what Paul and I thought was important in terms of the long-term vision that we tried to look at with these two major players. And these are nations that see themselves as much older, traditional countries with deep history and traditions that they're proud of. And it's very important that I think on the part of the leadership, both Xi and Putin, and also the society, to feel like that they're afforded the respect and importance in the international community that they feel that they deserve.
We're well into the 21st century. Just mentioned that we have been here for a long time. But let me just put it this way. Can one argue that the sun is setting on the so-called American century?
Well, you know, that's a very difficult position to argue, because still the United States, by any measure, remains overwhelmingly predominant power in the international community and military. China's a challenger. China and Russia together present more of a potential counterbalance and challenge to the United States. But, issues that we have in terms of American foreign policy today on the domestic front, in terms of what our role should be in the world, when we talk about America first, that in many ways suggests to some that we're sort of retreating from engagement in the international community, although I think that's impossible in the current world system. But I wouldn't go so far as to suggest that, you know, we'll see an inevitable transition. But I think when you look at the diversity of the international community and the capacity of other major players to exercise and exert influence, we're not in this unipolar moment anymore that we may have been in the period of the decade of the 1990s. We're moving in a much more multipolar direction, where I think the United States could best serve its interests in this context by having, you know, engaging, working with these partners and players in a way that has to be well thought out, sophisticated, and taking account of their interests as well as ours, and trying to work toward solutions for a very interdependent and dynamic international society.
Mm-hmm. Given your prescription for the best way forward there, how do you see our president, President Trump, meeting that challenge or not?
Well, I think, you know, at this point, there's still a lot of uncertainty regarding the future direction of American foreign policy. On the one hand, we talk about America first, but at the same time, it seems that, you know, we recognize and appreciate the fact that there's a demand for continued engagement on the part of the United States and the international community. So I think I'm like our allies in the international community, and like many nations of the international community, not sure what the next priorities and directions of the American agenda will be. Mm-hmm. But I can say from my perspective is, as a specialist working in the area of international politics and foreign policy and spending a lot of time working in the international community with nations throughout the world, that I really do believe that America's best interests in the 21st century have to be about seeking diplomatic solutions, understanding the complexity and dynamic nature of the world that we're living in, and doing all we can to work effectively with our partners. I mean, and that takes a lot. We can't solve all these issues just by military force alone, or taking an approach without those partners working with us. It's about engagement. Mm-hmm. No nation can solve these issues that humanity is dealing with at this point standing alone.
Mm-hmm. The changeover from the Obama administration, its foreign policy, to the Trump administration and its foreign policy has been a dramatic change, I think most would agree. I wonder, can you give us an idea of how China and Russia see the switch here in the United States? You mentioned America First, how they view it, favorably or otherwise?
Well, I think the Russians, to take the two separately, I think there's still considerable uncertainty on the part of both Moscow and Beijing about, the direction of American foreign policy. Because if we look at President Trump's points with respect to Russia during the campaign, He talked about, wouldn't it be great if we could work together with Russia? And he talked about building partnerships in counterterrorism. And then after assuming office, he confronts the realities of domestic politics, the investigation underway about potential Russian meddling in the election and the extent to which there may have been involvement with respect to the political process, the democratic political process in the United States. And so there was he's got the pressure coming from Congress in terms of dealing with Russia, and he hasn't been able to move forward on that agenda. And the Russians see that and recognize it. And I think they were initially hopeful that there might be potential for bettering the relationship or restoring normalcy in the U.S.-Russian bilateral relationship, but they appreciate and understand the fact that the president is very much constrained on the domestic front, and there's still considerable tension in the relationship. In fact, many people talk about the fact that we could be in a situation that's equivalent to the Cold War or something even less predictable. Mm-hmm. And on the Chinese side, it's similar. If you look at the president's statements during the campaign, it was quite tough on China. And then at the same time, after assuming office, at various times, he's appeared to be more willing to try to engage Beijing, particularly in helping with North Korea and some of the other priority issues for the United States. So I think we're all still in a period where we're trying to see how the Trump era of policies on the international stage will play out. But again, I go back to my point that we're a global power. We have global responsibilities. And while we certainly have considerable need for resources and looking out for any nation should look out for the interests of their own country as a first priority in the international system. But the world needs America's engagement and leadership and partnership building.
Cheryl Cross, stay in your seat, please, in the studio in Des Moines. Just a few minutes. We'll take a break and then talk to you for maybe five more minutes before we continue with our other guest. Cheryl Cross is with us, director of the Kosmetsky Center at St. Edward's University. She's a global policy scholar at the Kennan Institute, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, co-author of a soon-to-be-published book, China, Russia, and 21st Century Global Geopolitics. We'll be back with Cheryl Cross, and then on to particle physics and the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, finishing up a conversation with Cheryl Cross, global policy scholar. Cheryl, in the 5 minutes we have remaining, I'd just like to get to two or three more questions with quick answers, hopefully. I know this is involved stuff, but I'll ask you to be concise here. Let's talk a little bit about the investigations into the Russian meddling in our 2016 campaign and the probe into possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. From your view, as you focus in on Russia and China, well, Russia in particular, of course, here, the outcome of the Russia probe, whatever happens from this date on, how do you see that impacting Russian-U.S. relations long term?
Well, I think it's difficult to say. The investigation is, of course, important. But I think we also have to remember that Russia is a critical player in the international community, and the U.S.-Russian strategic relationship is critical. So we have to balance those factors together. I mean, you know, we can't I think it would be horrible if this leads to a complete, absolute return to a situation like the Cold War or something worse. We have a lot of common strategic interests. And there's a reality of it's difficult to be brief in responding to this, but we live in a world where we're, you know, increasingly going to confront nations seeking to exploit information advantage in the international community and in the vulnerabilities of the cyber world, the internet world. So I think one of the big lessons that could come out of this is making the American people increasingly aware of the vulnerability of information. We can't get all of our news from sources like social media and Facebook. We need a multiple range of sources and informed discussion. But I don't think it's going to change the reality that countries in the world community, our adversaries and others, will continue to exploit that information space in ways that suggest that we haven't really thought about in the past and can definitely have an impact. So we have to be aware and be vigilant.
Mm-hmm. And finally, a common view is that the Russian goal in what they did in 2016 was to not just to be on the side of having Donald Trump get into office, but to more broadly undermine Western democracy, our democracy, through hacked emails, the WikiLeaks, fake news spread through our social media. Would you think Vladimir Putin would say he has succeeded to any degree in that?
Mm-hmm. Well, number one, he doesn't admit that he was ever involved in it. That's the first thing.
Right. I said the common view. Unless we have Vladimir Putin here, I guess we won't know, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think that, the damage that these allegations have done to moving the relationship forward, ending sanctions on Russia or any other expectations, none of that has been achieved. So it's hard to say in the long term, but I think it has, you know, there's certainly been a lot of adverse repercussions as a result of the suggested involvement.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we go, if you could give one or two pieces of advice to our president in our relations with Russia, with China, what would they be?
Paul and I offered a conclusion at the end of our book suggesting that it might be very advantageous for the United States to recognize China and Russia as important players and perhaps have some kind of an arrangement where we work security issues together to try to deal with the most significant challenges that we face in countering terrorism, cybersecurity, et cetera, something like that. I mean, we can't go back to the Kissinger era expecting that we could place a wedge between these two powers because their strategic partnership has gone too far. But I think it would be so much better for the future security of the United States, for China and Russia, if we could find ways to work together on those issues that we face that are so important and certainly have positive developments for the entire international community.
Cheryl Cross will be speaking tonight in Des Moines via the Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. She stepped into our Des Moines studio to share with us some of her ideas. Also from the soon-to-be-published book she and Paul Bolt have written, China, Russia, and 21st Century Global Geopolitics. Cheryl Cross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, finishing up the hour from geopolitics to particle physics. Oh, we have light topics today on our program. Well, remember, you know, the makeup of the universe of matter, protons, neutrons, electrons. Well, we found out in recent years that's not the whole story. What about quarks or other classes of particles with different properties and functions? You also may have heard of the Large Hadron Collider. It's the world's largest particle accelerator. Now, inside the 17 miles round underground collider near Geneva, Switzerland, protons race at nearly the speed of light, and they collide with the aim of better understanding the stuff that makes the world and the fundamental composition of matter. This half hour, I want to talk with two scientists at Iowa State University who've been working on a project with the Large Hadron Collider. Jim Cochran is with us, Iowa State University professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Soren Prell is also a professor at Iowa State University in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Thank you for coming in as well, Soren.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let me start with you, Jim Cochran. Tell us a little bit more about the work at the Large Hadron Collider, something we've heard in our news, but most of us don't know really a heck of a lot about. What's going on there, and what is it trying to discover?
So, I mean, the idea is to, you know, better understand the universe, and we have this view of the world that we call the Standard Model, and it works great. It describes everything that we see, but we have good reason to believe that it's not the final story. And what we are basically trying to do is to find where it's broken or where it doesn't work, and this will give us new insights into the future, what lies beyond. Mm-hmm. As far as the practical work, it's the collaboration that we work on is 3,000 people, and there's a tremendous amount of work to do, and we never have quite enough people to do all of the work that's needed. Mm-hmm. But the detector is very large and a lot of technical.
You're talking about ATLAS. So you're the deputy manager of the U.S. ATLAS Operations Program. What do you mean by a detector?
So you mentioned about the protons colliding. So what happens is when they collide, we have to look at those collisions. So when they collide, lots of particles come out, and we have this five-story detector that sits underground that basically running at 40 megahertz, 40 million times a second, basically takes a picture of these collisions, and we analyze that.
Mm. Okay. Soren, help us understand a little bit more about your work, ISU's work, as involves the Large Hadron Collider.
One of the biggest achievements of the Large Hadron Collider so far was the discovery of the Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. There was a particle predicted by the Standard Model, but we didn't know if it would exist, and we didn't know if the Standard Model is correct. So the main purpose was to discover the Standard Model and discover the Higgs boson. And
So this was a particle. Higgs boson was a particle that existed in theory only until just a couple of years ago, until 2012, right?
That's correct. In 2012, ATLAS and CMS together discovered the Higgs boson. And we don't produce it and then we have it and lay it around and look at it. It decays right away. So we are constantly producing Higgs bosons and learning more about it, in which ways it decays and in which way it relates to other particles and in which way it relates to the physics of the universe.
Mm-hmm. And so is that why it was so hard to discover, to prove, take it out of theoretical into provable existence, because it exists for such little time?
In part. The other big part of the problem was we didn't have, before the Large Hadron Collider, we didn't have a powerful enough collider to produce Higgs bosons in enough quantity to study them. Mm-hmm. So when the Large Hadron Collider was built along with its detectors, we finally had an opportunity to produce and record the collisions and understand it in detail.
Mm-hmm. So take me back to what I started out with. Most of us grasp or hold on to our high school ideas of protons, neutrons, and electrons. We kind of picture that three-dimensional model of a molecule. What's been added to that, or is that model completely off these days?
So the protons are not, as far as we know today, are not the most fundamental particles. The proton itself is a composed particle, and it's made up of so-called quarks. And in addition to the proton and the electron, for example, has heavier siblings, if you want. They have similar particles but with different masses. And so we have now, if you wish, a miniature periodic system of the elements for quarks and electron types. And so that has changed since the protons and neutrons that is currently being taught.
So if you modeled this out, enlarged it, and made it into a model the size of a basketball, if you could, could you do that? There would just be more elements than the three, that the protons, neutrons, and electrons?
It's actually not that different. There are six types of quarks and six types of electron-type particles. So we're only talking about 12 particles total. So that's why I said it's a pretty small periodic table, if you want. Mm. And in addition to those, we often talk about the messenger particles that create forces, interactions between particles, like the electromagnetic interaction, which is responsible for electricity and magnetism.
Mm. Okay.
And it's not to say that your previous model of just proton, neutron, electron is wrong. It's simply not complete, and that there's some substructure to that we, you know, only mm-hmm. in the past 50 years or so have been able to
okay,
recover.
So now we're up to 12 particles in that model, in that structure, molecules. Do we know how much more there is to discover, Jim?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, we have the standard model, and everything that we have observed thus far agrees with it. You know, mm-hmm. anything that we expect beyond that is new physics and a very exciting, and that would be a huge deal for science.
Jim, let's talk more specifically, Jim and Soren, about ISU's work there. Let me remind our audience that I'm with Soren Prell and Jim Cochran. They're both professors at Iowa State University in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, and both work with the Large Hadron Collider. That's in Switzerland. It's huge. I read, is this true, Jim, the largest machine in the world, 17 miles around in this sort of loop, this racetrack underground, right?
I believe that's correct. If there is a larger machine, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. So you have both been there numerous times. Jim, tell us, what is it like to go there?
I mean, for my bureaucratic job, I actually have to go there about 10 times a year. I mean, it's basically like a large college campus full of physicists. It's probably the best way I can describe it. Now, going down into the where the detector is, or into the accelerator, that's a very unique experience. It's this sort of James Bondish experience, right? Where you know you're 100 meters underground and you're next to this five-story, you know, looks like a building with, you know, lots of exquisite electronics, you know, wires and everything coming out of all over the place. So it's a pretty impressive experience.
So, Soren, does it make a sound? Do you hear collisions? Anything that easy to understand?
As humans, we are not going close to the accelerator when it is taking data and operating, because there's a high level of radiation. So we are not actually listening to it. We are analyzing the results of the collisions read out by electronic pulses of our detectors.
Mm-hmm. So Soren, tell me a little bit. I understand you have some research that has to do with dark matter. Acquaint us with dark matter and what your research focused on.
So going back to your previous question where you asked, is this all particles that we know about? We have very good reason to believe that there's more in the universe than just the particles that we know about today. In fact, we think that 80% of the matter in the universe is made of stuff that we have no idea what it is. And it has become known under the name of dark matter. We know from it by looking at the universe. If you look at distant galaxies with a telescope, you can look at the stars and you see the stars in your telescope and you see them orbiting around the center of a galaxy. And based on the mass of those stars, it's you can calculate how fast those stars should be moving. And it is a big puzzle that they are moving at a very different speed as one would calculate based on their masses and our understanding of gravity.
They're moving too fast?
So, yeah.
And out away from, away so, exploding.
So they are moving too fast, and depending on how far away they are from the center of the galaxy, they are not moving in the right pattern as one would expect. Mm. And so a model to explain this is if the galaxy had a lot more matter than is visible through the telescope. And none of the known matter would qualify for providing this. And because you cannot see it, we call it dark matter. But it's just a name. We really don't know what it is.
And it hasn't been proven to really exist yet, as we were talking about earlier with the Higgs boson. It hasn't been proven.
That's correct. We only know from it about it from cosmological observations. But there are several models which say that if it is a specific type of new particle, there might be a chance that the Large Hadron Collider could produce it in the laboratory and that we could study it right there. And so a big part of the study of the Large Hadron Collider is search for dark matter and see if we can learn more about it.
Mm-hmm. So, Soren, will we be hearing in an Iowa State University press release soon that you have proven and located dark matter?
that would be nice.
No comment.
No comment, Jim. Why not? That's Nobel Prize and then some worthy, right?
Oh, sure. That would be, as I said, a huge deal.
Jim, tell us a little bit about the next big thing that you see among particle physicists. What is out there? We had the discovery of Higgs boson in 2012. What is the current holy grail among you folk?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think we don't really know. I mean, dark matter is certainly something that likely would exist. I mean, unless there's something really wrong with gravity, it's most likely some kind of new particle. But you know, at this point, we just don't know. But we're basically driven by experiment at this point. I mean, our field goes through cycles where, you know, sometimes we have so much new stuff and we have no idea what it is and we require theory to kind of figure everything out and you know, come up with a new view. But now we're in a mode where, you know, the theorists have produced many things, but none of them we have seen. So the next big thing is we don't know, but we're pretty sure there is something.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to visit the Large Hadron Collider, to be among so many smart people from so many countries working together? You know, do the political differences between countries sort of disappear? You're all particle scientists?
They really do. And I have to say, this is one of the really quite wonderful things about going there, right? Because you have many nations of the world where the countries don't get along and don't have relations, but those people can very well be working side by side on an analysis, you know, and people there work very hard, as you might imagine. They're, you know, typical graduate students and postdocs. So they work a lot and, you know, for the most part, everybody gets along and do their science.
Mm-hmm. That collider is huge. We think perhaps the largest machine ever created in a circular pattern, almost 17 miles around that these particles race in. Soren, is this adequate to test everything we want to find out about the makeup of the universe? Or will we have to build an even larger collider in the future?
There are certainly discussions going on and plans on what the next collider should be. One thing that I'm sure the viewers have heard of is the Einstein's relations of energy equals mass times speed of light squared.
Mm-hmm.
So the more energy our collider has, the more massive particle we can create in these collisions. And it could be that dark matter, which is 80% of the universe, it could be that it's not just one single particle. It could be a whole zoo of particles. And some of them might be accessible at the Large Hadron Colliders. And for some, to understand the full picture, you may want the next generation machine to do that.
Did you say a whole zoo of particles?
That's what I said.
I love that picture that we might be able to someday, in some form, go to a particle zoo and then really get an idea of what is in this cage compared to the other cage. But I suppose we couldn't do that.
That's our dream.
Tell me a little bit more about what you hope to achieve there in the future, in the couple minutes that we have. Quantum computing, perhaps. You can tell us a little bit about quantum computing and if that is possible.
I mean, clearly quantum computing is possible.
What is it, though? Just remind us.
Oh. So typically your computer has bits of ones and zeros. And in a quantum computer, basically, you're able to have any variation between a one and a zero. And I'm probably not qualified to speak in any great detail on quantum computing. But right now, it's experimental, and it's not, you know, there's no practical use yet, as mm-hmm. far as I understand. Mm-hmm. Maybe Soren actually has more on that. I think he included that in his course at some point.
Perhaps I can go back to the original question you asked: what we think about the future. When you think about, we've just learned the Higgs boson 5 years ago. That's what we saw it the first time, and so there's dark matter might be a completely different type of matter that we will learn a lot more, hopefully, in the near future. We are at a stage now where we were with the electron about 100 years ago. When the electron was discovered, nobody thought about how you can use electricity in the myriad ways that we are doing today. So we are just exploring what the materials that we are working with, we really cannot predict what it will be used for in the future.
Okay. Very good. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your research, making it accessible to us. Jim Cochran, Iowa State University professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. Soren Prell, also in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, a professor there as well. Thank you for coming into our studio in tribute to your work. This is They Might Be Giants, Particle Man. I don't know if you know this tune.
I know this song.
Jim and Soren, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
It was a pleasure.
Triangle Man hates Particle Man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle Man.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Robbie Broad. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Universe Man, Universe Man. Size of the entire universe, man. Usually kind to smaller man. Universe Man. He's got a watch with a minute hand.